Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, a podcast that aims to address divorce, separation and co-parenting here in the UK, countering the often sensationalist way it's portrayed in the media, challenging the status quo and driving for reform. On each episode, I'm joined by experts to discuss divorce, separation and co-parenting from different angles and to give their opinions and to debate them. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor and divorce coach, co-founder of Amicable, the divorce services company, and host of this, the Divorce Podcast. In this episode, I was joined by journalist and comedian Ellie Gibson to discuss relationship struggles and how to make a marriage work in the wake of a separation. Ellie is the co-host of number one parenting podcast, Scummy Mummies. She joined forces with Helen Thorne to become the Scummy Mummies in 2013, and they've gone on to produce an award-winning podcast, a sell-out touring comedy show, and a popular book. We explored Ellie's relationship and how separation and space ended up making her marriage stronger, resulting in two beautiful children with her husband Pete. Ellie's description of the lead-up to her split from her now husband Pete was incredibly relatable. A sequence of small arguments about tiny things, yet fundamental issues, led to the couple deciding to take a series of breaks. Ellie found individual therapy really useful in getting to a place where she could reconcile with her husband. She described the impact of her best friend's divorce on her and her husband, and she talked about the importance of trying to navigate tough patches rather than giving up or cheating. This episode is a homage to marriage and the work required to keep a relationship strong. If you really loved this episode or want to hear more episodes like this, then please make sure to rate us on your preferred listening platform. Enjoy the episode. Welcome, Ellie.
One of them's all right, just to be clear. One of the children is fine. I shan't say which one. But yes, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
It's lovely to see you. And as I said, we've had your fellow co-host from Scummy Mummies on, Helen, and she discussed her divorce. And so now we're talking a bit more back from the brink. So shall we start? Tell us a little bit about your relationship and how old you were when you met your husband and sort of all of the background stuff.
So my husband's name is Pete, and we met in the first, I think the first week of university when we were 18. And I write about this in Helen's book, Get Divorced, Be Happy. But so why am I even plugging her book when it's a podcast about me?
Because here
we go.
So
that's a good
friend.
Friendship. Yeah. I do love her. And it's an excellent book, especially the bit that I wrote. But I actually started the bit about, you know, the first time I met Pete, he and I have talked about this. I didn't fall instantly in love with him, which weirdly I did with Helen. There's different kinds of love, as we know. But yes, the first time I met him, I was like, oh, who's that guy? And then we did become friends, but we didn't get together, I think, for 5 or 6 years into the friendship. And then I did find out he'd had a crush on me for quite a lot of that time, which is very gratifying, obviously. So yeah, we got together in our sort of early mid-20s. Then we were together for a bit. We lived together for a few years. And then we split up for a couple of years, but not properly, really. We did live apart for a year, and then we got back together, and then we got married in 2010. So we've been married, yeah, for it'll be 12 years this summer, but together on and off, probably about 20, something like that. Yeah.
Right. And it sounds like this on off living together sometimes, not living together other times, that's been a characteristic of your relationship. Has that been part of what's made it a success, do you think?
So we had this sort of 2 year separation. And for the first year of that, we did live together, still in the same flat and in the same bed. So you can imagine, you know, it was all a bit Ross and Rachel, you know, it was all sort of, we weren't together, but we weren't really seeing other people. But that obviously was a silly situation, and it was just untenable. So after a year of that sort of daftness, he said, I'm going to move out. We need a clean break. And I said, yes, I need my own space. You know, he said, I'm going to buy a flat, so we've got space. So obviously he bought a flat 4 minutes up the road that overlooked my grandmother's flat. So he really needed a lot of distance. He really wanted to get away.
I was going to say, what made you split up in the first place? So what do you think, what got you to the point of saying, actually, you know what, this isn't working? I think a lot of people struggle with this. When do you know it's over question? So what was it that made you split up?
Well, obviously it was over a sort of long period of arguments. And most of the arguments were about, I think we were at different stages in our lives. And so the relationship was sort of, you know, I was like, I wasn't desperate to sort of immediately have, we both talked about we wanted to have kids. So we knew that was in our future. And it wasn't I was desperate to have a baby immediately, but I did want to make sure that the person I was with would be a good dad and would be a good husband. So I think when I was coming up to 30, I was kind of like, you know, I need to make sure this is the right relationship for the rest of my life. And I love this person, but I don't know, you know, he was living a very student-y life still, you know, where he wanted to stay up late all the time. And at weekends, you know, he wouldn't get out of bed before sort of 2 p.m. Whereas I'd sort of moved on a bit and was like, well, no, I want to do something with my time. And also, if you can't get out of bed by lunchtime on a weekend now, you know, am I going to be on my own with a baby doing nappies all weekend? And I just didn't want that. So we argued, you know, but we argued mainly about the house, the mental load, of course, which I'm sure you've talked about before, but the mental load of me managing the house and then doing all the housework and stuff like that. And yeah, it just sort of reached the point where we were arguing a lot. And then there was, to be honest, there was a particular moment where he said he wouldn't go to the pub after work. I think he was going to come home and we were going to talk about the relationship and whether or not to carry on with it. And he was late. He was late home. And I just kind of, I did lose it a bit, but in a sort of weirdly, frighteningly calm way. Do you know what I mean? Some people, you know, they really are angry when they're not shouting at you.
Yeah. It's that steely, it's when you get that steely kind of coldness, isn't it? When you've just, it's gone too far. Yeah.
Yeah. So he came in the flat a couple of hours. Like, again, it wasn't like midnight. It was just a couple of hours. But I was just like, I just don't think this is important to you as it is to me, because I, you know, otherwise you wouldn't have gone for a pint. So I think that is just, that's the final straw. That just proves we're at different stages and we're attaching a different level of priority to this. So I think we're done. And that was the moment, basically. Yeah.
And what was his reaction? Do you think, was he shocked or do you think he...
He was quite shocked.
He was just waiting for somebody else to say it. I mean, sometimes that's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, as I say, we had been arguing a lot and I think he did sort of accept it, and it was, that was kind of what that was. But then, as I say, from that moment, there was then literally years of actually trying to disentangle from each other. And even after he moved out, we would try to be friends and we would see each other. And of course, things would get, let's say, romantic. I'm sure it's a family-friendly podcast. Things would get romantical after a few drinks. So again, there was another sort of crisis moment where we went to a friend of a friend's party. We had a massive row. There was a big scene. It was all awful. And he ended up coming back to my flat and we talked through it the whole night and we agreed that we couldn't see each other at all. And this really was the final bit. And he left in the morning and we all cried all day and we agreed not to see each other for a month at all. No contact, no messages, no nothing. And then after 3 weeks, we both stuck to that. And then after 3 weeks, he turned up at my house one Saturday afternoon with a 10-page letter, basically, that he'd written. I found it later by going around to various friends' houses and getting them to help him with it. But saying all the things that he felt sad about and, you know, saying, actually, basically, it said, I am ready to start a proper grown-up life and I want to do it with you, and I've made a big mistake. And that sounds like it's putting all on him, and of course it isn't. I take responsibility as well for a lot of what went wrong, but that is what happened anyway.
Wow. So when he came back and said all of that, was it just what you were waiting and wanting to hear, and therefore it made complete sense just to rekindle the relationship on a different footing, or did you still have doubts?
Well, when he first appeared with this letter, I just told him to go away and I didn't really want to hear it. And I was like, you know, I've worked really hard to stay away from you for 3 weeks and I feel like I'm rebuilding myself. And, you know, I had been on a date with someone else and things like that. And I was like, you know, like, no. But then, so I didn't even read the letter. I just went out with my friend. We went to Gay Pride and had some cocktails. And then I got home. But I was just really sad and I couldn't stop thinking about the letter. And I got home, I think, before midnight and I read it. And yes, it was a lot of things I wanted to hear. So I just went round his flat. And then that was sort of that. Like the next day, we just sort of went back into relationship mode. But we did talk a lot about what had to be different and things that had to change. And I did see a therapist because I wanted to make sure, that I wasn't just getting back into a relationship for the sake of being in a relationship. You know, I know that issues aren't resolved by a letter and a snog, you know, and I wanted to make sure that I was making the right decisions for me, but also for both of us, and that equally he wasn't kind of doing that. And I just had to some stuff to work for about myself, which I did. So yeah, we still had fights and we still had to iron out things, but we did, and we talked about it a lot, and it was good.
And what do you think then in a successful relationship is the fundamental thing then? Because you obviously went through a period where you weren't sure. You know, he had to come back with a personal commitment to change. You had to do some personal work and you had to change. What was the fundamental thing then in terms of the relationship? What is it? What makes a successful relationship? What changed for you? Because a month ago it wasn't successful. The next month there's a commitment to make it successful. What made it successful then, beyond a commitment?
Well, I think it was him actually stepping up and doing stuff differently. And me, it was about me realising that him perhaps not doing stuff in the house that I wanted him to do, not being supportive in that way, wasn't actually necessarily about me or him disrespecting me or not loving me. Because I was in this mindset of, you know, you do these things that upset me and bother me, and you know they're going to upset me and bother me, so you must not care about my feelings, or you must actively want to annoy me or hurt me. And it sounds like I'm just complaining about, I don't know, like occasionally not taking the bins out, which was part of that. But as I would say to him, it's often, isn't it? It's hundreds of those little things. It's like when I went away on a work trip and I came back after a week and the plates from the meal I cooked the night before were still there, you know. And everything else in the flat was dirty. We didn't have a dishwasher. And I just put my bag down and I just walked out of the flat. I just said, you know, there was no milk in the fridge that I could have a cup of tea. It was just things like that. So, which again, I'm not trying to just list all his past crimes, but I'm just being honest. This is things like that are just built up and built up. And I needed to know that there was going to be a change and that wasn't going to be the situation forever. And he did prove that he did change. And then in more recent years, since we've been married, we have talked a lot about the mental load. And I've tried to get better at explaining, saying to me, why didn't you ask me to do that? Or what do you need me to do? Is a whole other job in itself. I need you to go, oh, right, they've got a birthday party to go to on Saturday.
I'll need a birthday present. I'll need to know where it is, what time it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Or equally, we've worked together. We've worked on strategies. So in that example now, I buy all the birthday presents. I buy all the presents for the kids' birthday parties. His job is to wrap them and make sure the card gets written or made. And then, so that's, you know, you could nitpick about who's still doing the lion's share of the work there. But I think the point is that's like a division of labour that now we don't have to argue about anymore. So it's just working out stuff like that.
I mean, you mentioned a couple of times it feels like you're nitpicking, but it isn't, because that's the stuff that makes or breaks relationships ultimately. And we know from research as well that the majority of relationships end over the small stuff. So yeah, so Relate have done some really interesting work on that, but it's the small stuff that ultimately breaks relationships, because it is a mental load, as you say, and it is exhausting. And I think a lot of people find it very frustrating as well. But I think what sounds quite different in your case was, though, it sounds like you were able to communicate. And you were able to actually have a conversation once you'd come back with the letter to say, okay, let's talk about this, and to be realistic and not to want it to be all perfect, but to have some realistic expectations. And I love what you were just saying then about we had some strategies, because I think that's ultimately what makes relationships work. They are hard work and you have to work at them.
Yeah. And sometimes for us, rules, as uptight and boring as that makes me sound, rules I've found quite useful. I like them with the kids. You know, again, it's not that they can never be broken. It's not about bedtime at 6:01 p.m. But I found that with the kids, they quite like a sort of boundary. And if it's agreed, and that's, again, I'm not trying to make Pete sound like a child, but I've actually learned from my relationship with him how to sort of manage that a bit better. And then, you know, We even had Pete and I had a row this morning about I'm going for a lunch, and I hadn't put in the exact times I'd be at the lunch. And he was like, well, is it going to be a long lunch? And I said, right, I tell you what, here's what we're going to do going forward. Just always assume it's a long lunch. Just always assume it's me. It probably is. Because I work nights for Scummy Mummies. If I want to see my friends, I have to go in the daytime. So, and then he has to do the pickup of the kids and blah, blah, blah. So I was like, let's just assume from now on that it's a long lunch. If it's not, I'll tell you, it never will be short. It never will be.
Well, how do you characterise your marriage now then? Because it sounds like all marriages, aren't they? All relationships are a journey. But what sort of way do you characterise the relationship now?
I think mostly pretty happy and pretty solid. As I say, we had a fight this morning. Do you know what I mean? I think all marriages are up and down and have good patches and bad patches. And I think a lot of that can be to do with external things, what happens. And, you know, our son Joe, who's 7 now, and he's a very healthy, happy little boy. But when he was born 2 months early. So that obviously, he was in hospital for 6 weeks. He's fine now, but at the time it was incredibly stressful and upsetting. And in a funny way, it brought us closer than we had been. Because suddenly we had all this time we were spending together in the hospital, and we had this thing in common, this problem that we had to solve together and get through together. And we, you know, we had all these car journeys to and from the hospital, and it sounds awful. We had some real laughs, you know, as well as moments of real intimacy, emotional intimacy. We just had some good laughs. And then weirdly, after he was better and he was at home, I think we went through another tough patch because, you know, and I didn't realize the time I was mentally dealing with the aftermath of that sort of car crash. And he'd gone back to work, so his life was quite normal. And I just had this baby, and I had this baby who could potentially still have been quite ill, and I had another son as well. And I was really struggling, and I don't think I was communicating that properly then.
Well, I imagine you were quite lonely as well, weren't you, having had all of each other's attention and focused attention, to then go back to having your separate lives where you're a stay-at-home mum and doing your old stuff, and he's going back to work. That must have been very isolating.
Yes, I think that was part of it. And I think a lot of it was when you have a premature baby, certainly my experience, when the baby's well and out of hospital, it's like the end of the film and everyone just kind of goes, oh, great, it's the end of the film, it's all fine, including you. You know, I was sitting there going, oh, everything's fine and normal now. And it's only now I can sort of look back and go, well, it wasn't though, but I was acting like it was normal. So no wonder he didn't know that I was not doing okay, because I didn't know I was not doing okay, really. So I guess I'm just using that as an example of, you know, that's life, isn't it? It's sort of, it's up and down. And another weird thing that what happened to Helen, I think, actually brought us closer together. My best friend going for a divorce, you know, we had to have lots of conversation because her husband did have an affair for 4 years, and that was such a big shock. You know, we had to kind of sit down and go, just to be clear, first of all, you're not doing that, are you? Okay, just checking. But also, if you feel like doing that, you know, or if you sort of start doing that, even if you fall into something like that, can we agree that we're going to have a conversation about that, ideally before it happens, certainly if it happens at the beginning, whether or not it's about whether to stay together through it, can we at least be honest with each other about the fact we're not happy? So it's brought up a lot of stuff for us in, I think, quite a positive way.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, you know, the statistics show that if your friend's divorced, it's more likely to have an impact on your relationship, and you're potentially statistically more likely to divorce. But I love the way that you've tackled that by just facing it straight on and saying, right, well, let's talk about this, rather than just, you know, a lot of people, I think, just sweep it under the carpet and say, well, that's them. There's clearly, we've always known there's something wrong with their relationship, and sort of push it away, don't they, in complete denial. But I love the fact that you just face that straight on and say, well, let's talk about it. Somebody you love is going through something like that. Then let's have it out. Let's say what it would be like for us and what we would do. I think, you know, listening to what you're saying, it strikes me that because you've confronted some of the hard stuff and you've put yourself on the line with, are we going to carry on? Are we not going to carry on? You've made an active choice to stay at several points in time rather than just falling into a long-term relationship, which I think is what a lot of people potentially do, and then wake up, you know, 20 years later when their kids have grown up and think, well, what was that about? And now we've got nothing in common, and the thing that was holding us together, the family life, that's changed too. So you can see why a lot of people divorce in later life.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I'm very grateful for, you know, that I'm sort of making light of it now, but that thing with Pete and I went through, that separation and all that, and the very long drawn out process, at the time it was really hard. It was really painful and upsetting. And now I'm really grateful that we did go through that, because, yeah, I have a sort of confidence in, no, I did, you know, we made the right choice, and stuff gets hard and then we get through it. But having said that, equally, you know, because of what happened to Helen, and our boys are friends, and they obviously overhear us, we try to keep it from them. But we have to be honest with them about what's going on, you know, and they're asking questions. We've had to sit them down, and they say to this day, periodically, you know, are you and Dad going to get a divorce like Helen? And I can't look them in the face and say never, really, because none of us know that. I don't think anyone gets married thinking, we'll get this. So I just have to say we're not planning to, and we love each other very much. And, you know, we're not going to do what Will did. And that's what else can I say to them, really? I mean, what do you say to them in that situation? I don't know.
Well, I think it's best to be honest. I think, you know, we rush in sometimes as parents to try and give absolute certainty to children. And I think that is unhealthy in the long term. It solves the problem in the very short, immediate term. It makes you feel better to be able to say that. But ultimately, you run the risk of them losing trust and faith in you if something does happen later down the line. And like you say, you're not in control of it as an individual. It's a partnership. So you can't control what the other person does. So it's a very brave person that puts themselves out there and says, no, this is never going to happen. I think it's dangerous. I think you're right. I think it's better to be as reassuring as you can, but there has to be reality and honesty with children, even young children, because they can understand. And the importance of trust is massive in the relationship. The one thing you don't want to do is lose their trust. So overpromising is tough. And it's the same way, you know, there's often people that put out stuff. So like, I can't remember, like Sue Atkins puts out loads of stuff about how to talk to children about certain events, whether it's terrorism or divorce or whatever. And always the message is to be honest, but you don't have to go into loads of detail. So, you know, to be straightforward and honest with a child is better because it builds their resilience, it builds their understanding, it keeps the communication channel open, and it builds the trust between you. So I think you're right. I think the things you can do are be as reassuring as possible whilst still obviously being truthful. You cannot guarantee.
Well, that's lovely. At least that's one thing about parenting I might not be messing up, Kate. So that's great. They don't eat vegetables or anything, but, you know, they don't practice the guitar, but I'm being honest with them about divorce. Good. Good for me.
definitely a tick in the box. I think the other interesting thing you're talking about is, like, you know, you do argue, everybody argues, and people often say, well, is it wrong to argue in front of children? No, it's dead normal, but it's how you explain and how they see you resolve that argument. That's the important thing. So how do you resolve arguments in your household?
Yes, of course. And I think before we had children, you know, my parents did fight a lot growing up when I was growing up, and still do, to be honest. And you know how, like, before you have children, you're very smug and you're like, we'll never fight in front of them and they'll never have iPads and they won't have sugar until they're 24. And then you have a baby and it turns out the baby has not read those memos. Do you know what I mean? The baby doesn't understand that that's the plan and it's supposed to sleep for 8 hours a night and all of that. The baby didn't get that message. So, and that's definitely been a thing. We have completely fought in front of them, because if you're like in a car arguing about directions, you can't quietly go and do it somewhere else. I'm not proud to say this. We have done the WhatsApp argument as well, which often starts as a real argument. And then one of you manages to say, not, you know, we can't in front of the kids. So you go away, but then you angry text each other from different
rooms. Bashing on the screen.
Yes. We have definitely done that. And I'm not proud of that. On the other hand, I do think that's better than continuing to shout at each other in front of them. So, and sometimes you do have more things to say. So maybe that's a needs must situation. I don't know. So, yes, and we do, when we have fought in front of them, which we do, we try when we're doing the making up to do at least some of the making up in front of them. So even if we have to have the heated or serious conversation in another room, we do often make a point of going, look, we've made up now, we're having a cuddle, I've said sorry, he said sorry, blah, 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 because we'd really like them to say sorry to us when they mess up, which they rarely do. But, you know, that's a whole other thing, isn't it? Do you force children to say sorry when they don't mean it? I feel like that's insincere. So I feel like I'm just at least trying to show them that's what we do. And then, you know, we'll see.
I think it's better to role model it when you genuinely know that you need to apologise rather than to force them. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And we apologise to them. We say, you know, we're sorry for fighting in front of you, because they hate it. Of course they do. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think it's hard for kids, isn't it? Because they always worry about the D word if they see you arguing. But it's a normal, natural part of life. And they do need to develop resilience and relationship resilience as well.
Yes, I think. Yeah, I don't think we'd be doing them a service if we were raising them to think that people never fight and never fight publicly. And, you know, and again, we do have certain rules. We try not to swear in front of them. We've both broken that rule on occasion, to be honest. And we don't do name calling. And we also have a rule that doesn't necessarily come up in rounds with them, but we don't accuse each other of being like our parents, because that can really, like the touch paper. So we've had to agree that that's not a thing.
Yes. And yeah. With your family, you know, when you were going through the different sort of, you know, the Ross and Rachel bit, or the on-off bit, or the coming together finally kind of part, what roles did your family play in this? Were they supportive of the relationship? Did they interfere, or was this just something you didn't speak to them about?
They didn't interfere, no, but they were very supportive to both of us. I remember Pete went away and I think he had a weekend with his mum and dad to talk it all through, and he found that really helpful. My parents, I'm very close to both my parents, and my mum especially listened to me talk about the whole thing for, again, literally years, and was brilliant, actually. She was brilliant. She listened to me and she would offer advice and kindness, but she was always very careful never to overstep the mark. She never said, well, this is what you should do and blah, blah, blah. And when we did get back together and we did get married, she was like, oh, I'm so relieved. I'm so relieved. You've no idea. And I was like, really? And she said, I've always loved him. I knew he was brilliant. And I really wanted you to get back together. But I knew I couldn't say that to you, because I knew if I said that and then it went wrong, it would be all my fault. And it might not have been the right decision anyway. You were the only one who could make that decision. But my God, all I've wanted to say to you for months was, oh, give it another go. So she's very glad it worked out like it did. So, yeah, our parents, we were really lucky to have our parents around and to have them be supportive, I think.
And what do you think about sort of marriage as an institution now, having got married and being, as you've described it, pretty happy?
How do I feel about marriage? I'll be honest, I really like being married. I like the companionship of it. I like, frankly, the practical element of having somewhere there. To have someone there where you can go, oh, fuck, I need to pay this council tax bill. Will I do this? Can you ring the plumber? Stuff like that. I like that. I mean, that's very romantical, isn't it? But that, again, I just think that's grown-up life. Yes, and I do like the romance of it and the coupliness of it, and I like the stuff we have in common. And I will say that Pete and I don't actually have that much in common in terms of, we don't have the same hobbies. I like video games. He doesn't. He likes going to concerts. I couldn't care less, you know.
God, you would never get together on a dating app these days then, would you? You'd be swiping the other way across each other. This is what worries me about the whole dating app thing. Oh, my goodness. You found somebody that you would never, ever meet on a dating app and you're happily married.
Exactly. This is it. I wouldn't pick him again, Kate, let's say that. I'd swipe the other way. No, but we do have things in common. We love going on holiday. We have our kids in common now, obviously. We love eating. I love cooking, but he doesn't like cooking, but that's fine because he does the washing up. So again, we've worked out. So I'm happy, but I don't think marriage is necessarily for everyone. And I know a lot of people with marriages who aren't happy, and I fully support people who are like, you know what, the balance of this, you know, the balance of sort of misery or unhappiness is outweighing the companionship, the practical help and the romance. I think there's many, many relationships that I personally know of where that's the situation, in which case, why stay married? To quote Helen's book yet again, get divorced, be happy. I hope she's going to pay me for this.
You're on a license, yeah. And what about, is it marriage for life then? So you can love marriage. Is marriage for life a realistic concept, given that we live till we're 90, or potentially the people that have been born now over 100?
Well, funny enough, that is one of my mother's famous sayings. You know, she said to me once, you know, Ellie, when marriage was invented, people died at 35. So they got married at 11, but then they were dead in 24 years. People weren't supposed to survive this long. And I think that's quite an interesting point. Again, I have another set of friends. He doesn't like marriage. He hates the whole idea of marriage. He's also quite anti-religious, so he didn't want to get married. But he agreed when they made civil partnerships, they're a straight couple, so when they made civil partnerships, a straight couple allowed, he agreed to that. But I remember they had a lot of discussions over years. They've got kids and all of that, and about why not. And he said to her, well, I can't stand up in front of all our friends and look you in the face and promise to love you and be with you forever, because none of us know that that's going to happen. None of us know that that's true. And I really, she's one of my dearest, bestest friends. And I really understood exactly what he meant. And I thought he had a point. I thought, you know, none of us know what's going to happen, you know, who we're going to meet, or what, just how we're going to change as humans, as people as we get older. So I don't think it is forever necessarily. But having said that, I could see her point, which was, well, yes, but none of us know that, but that's not really what marriage is about. It's not about literally doing that. It's about saying, I'm going to do my best. You know, I like you, I pick you, I want to be with you forever, and I'm going to do my best to make that work. And I think that, for me, is what marriage is now. As long as you're both committed to that, then I think you've got a good shot.
Yeah, and it's different to raising children. So before, marriage has been the vehicle for raising children, but now I think you can raise children as separated parents and still do a wonderful job. I'm not saying it's ideal, but you can still do a wonderful job raising your kids. So you don't need marriage to be that vehicle.
Absolutely.
So I just wonder then, marriage feels like it's more of a choice rather than an economic necessity for women particularly or anything else. It feels like it's become a choice, and therefore maybe it's even more precious in some ways.
Yeah, I think so. And of course, there are lots of women, especially around the world, for whom it is still an economic necessity. And that's a whole other thing, isn't it? But I think, yeah, those of us who are lucky enough to be able to make that choice, I think it's a great thing that we can, really. And I think, yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, when her kids are with Helen, they know that they're the priority for Helen and they know how loved they are by her. And they're very happy they're getting on with it. So absolutely, it's doable if you prioritise your kids, of course. Yeah.
So we're just coming up to the end. It's been lovely talking to you. But just finally then, what are your best tips for anyone who's in a position where they may be separated and thinking about reconciling? What did you learn most from that period of your life? What would you say to somebody who might be listening?
Oh, gosh. All I can talk about is I'm not a therapist or any kind of expert. I liked it when you said at the beginning of the podcast, we have experts or not today, we don't. I'm just an idiot. So I can only speak of my experience. But for me and Pete, in the end, it was separation. Even though it was only 3 weeks, it was about kind of realizing that we did miss each other and we did love each other very much. But perhaps more importantly, I think it was communicating what we needed and then communicating what we were willing to give. And as I say, it wasn't like that was the end of the film. It wasn't like we got back together and then we never fought again. To this day, it's an ongoing daily working out whose responsibility is for what and explaining how I feel and for Pete to do that as well. You know, what there was a time when I remember one time he said, oh, I've been talking to my dad saying I've been a bit, you know, worried about how we're doing. And I was really upset because I was like, well, I'm here and I'm in this marriage. Why don't you talk to me? And he was like, well, I couldn't because I need to work for my feelings. So do you know what I mean? It's, and now I have more, I do understand, but that was a compromise as well. We had to agree that he would talk to me, but also I had to be okay with him talking to other people because that's how we work stuff out.
Oh, look, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. It's the time has raced by. Where can people find out more about you and what you're doing, Ellie?
Well, Scummy Mummies, I'm in this double act with this woman, Helen, who I may have mentioned. Yes, if you go to scummymummies.com, you can see dates of all. We do live comedy shows, much funnier than I've been on this podcast, I promise you, much less serious. You can go and see our live comedy show all over the country. We're going to Edinburgh in August for 10 days. And we've got a podcast, we've got Instagram and all of that. I'm also on Into Games, if you like that. I'm on Twitch and all that, Ellie Gibson Games. I'm on Ellie Gibson on Twitter. And Helen's written a book called Get Divorced, Be Happy. Don't know if I mentioned it.
Only once.
It's an excellent book.
It is an excellent book. I've read it. It's absolutely brilliant. Really sound advice as well. And it's a wonderful journey. And you do feature very heavily as well.
That's because I'm an extremely massive deal. So yes, that's correct. That's the correct amount of weight in that book. Yes.
And of course, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kate_Daly. And you can hear about new podcast episodes by following at divorce_podcast. And if you've loved listening to Ellie and want to find out more about this podcast and subscribe for updates, you can visit thedivorcepodcast.com. Thank you very much, Ellie, for coming on the podcast. And thank you, too, for listening.